You're listening to La Raza Chronicles, Crónicas de la Raza. On tonight's show, Julieta Kuznir interviews researcher Carlos Martinez about what's happening on the ground in Tijuana. They discuss how current U.S. asylum and deportation policies have created a health crisis. Greg Landau interviews Mexican singer-songwriter Laura Reboloso about her recent work, Sones y Canciones para Reverdecer. Laura Reboloso celebrates the experience of Mexican women and has innovated new paths in son jarocho and Mexican folk music. Plus, we feature some new songs. La Raza Chronicles is produced by Julieta Kuznir, Nina Serrano, Greg Landau, and myself, Brenda Yescas. Stay tuned.
You're listening to La Raza Chronicles, Crónicas de la Raza. We see a lot of news talking about all the many issues that we're seeing in D.C., you know, issues locally. But what is often pushed to the side, the impact that we've seen of Trump's immigration policy and also how our border communities are being impacted by COVID. And we are very, very lucky to have on the line with us Carlos Martinez, who has been researching and working on these issues closely. He is speaking to us from Tijuana. He's a PhD candidate in the joint program in medical anthropology at UC Berkeley and UC San Francisco. Carlos, thank you so much for being on with us.
Hi, Julieta. Thank you so much for having me on today.
So, Carlos, let's get started. I feel like a lot of people don't realize that these policies, since there was a lot that Trump has done in his time in office, one of the things he did was change a lot of policies around the processes to request asylum. So can you walk people through what is the situation like for migrants? And you are in Tijuana now. Who is in Tijuana and what are you seeing, and you know, what is the data showing?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's important to always remind people that, of course, Trump's policies have been in some ways a radical break from, particularly from asylum policy as it's been played out in U.S. immigration policy for several years, but also it's part of a longer trajectory of immigration policy and attempts at anti-migrant enforcement, the border wall and things like that, right? But what Trump has done throughout these 4 years has been really disastrous for people who have been seeking asylum. And of course, many people will recall back in 2018 in particular, there were several caravans of migrants or people seeking asylum in the United States that were migrating from Central America, most predominantly at that time from Honduras, but also from El Salvador and Nicaragua, Guatemala, and in other countries as well. In response to that, the Trump administration implemented several policies that sought to basically make it much more difficult for asylum seekers to be able to access the asylum process in general, and also and from being able to even to seek asylum. And in fact, you know, the Trump administration has been really effective, really shutting down asylum, right? I think it's important that people understand that asylum law is really part of international law, right? The right to seek asylum is something that has been enshrined in international conventions and treaties. And it's certainly something that the United States has ostensibly ascribed to as well. But the Trump administration has really broken with that in several ways. And it did that, you know, first by implementing some pretty arbitrary processes by which people had to get on a list. This has been referred to as the metering process, where asylum seekers arriving to border cities like Mexico were required to get on this list that had no real legal, you know, backing around it. But this list that through which basically people would be called according to a number to then be brought over to the United States to then be processed for asylum. So that was sort of a first thing which Trump implemented that slowed down asylum for people incredibly. It slowed down the asylum process, right? As people were arriving to Mexico, to Mexican border cities. And then later, Trump implemented what has been referred to as the MPP program, the Migrant Protection Protocols. Ironically, Migrant Protection Protocols is what it's referred to, even though it actually is doing the opposite of protecting migrants. It's also referred to as the Stay in Mexico program. And basically what that did is that it forced asylum seekers to return to Mexico or to their countries of origin while awaiting their asylum case to be heard. Since the initiation of that program, at the beginning of 2019, approximately 60,000 asylum seekers have been returned to Mexico. And also there have been other asylum seekers that have been returned to Central American nations during that time to await their court dates. And so what that's meant is that whereas earlier asylum seekers would be able to access the United States under asylum law, would be able to enter the United States while waiting their court dates, they've been forced to stay in Mexico. And this has basically turned Mexican border cities like Tijuana, where I've been conducting my research, and other cities like Ciudad Juarez and Matamoros, into really waiting rooms for asylum seekers, right? It turned them into long-term sort of waiting rooms for, you know, thousands of asylum seekers, people who have been forced to find some sort of housing, to access medical care, which is very difficult, of course, during that time, and has placed them in really vulnerable conditions, right? Because we know that in many cases, asylum seekers are often escaping violence associated with gang violence. In some cases, this gang violence is associated with kind of narco trafficking organizations. In the case of Honduras, we know that these narco trafficking organizations are also have relationships with, of course, the government of Honduras. As we've come to know, even to the very top of Honduras's government, with the president himself of Honduras being implicated in sort of drug trafficking in his family as well. So, you know, these are very powerful narco organizations in some cases that people are escaping, basically. In some cases, it's because they really are political asylum seekers or political refugees, in that they are people who were opposed to, for example, Honduras, the Juan Orlando Hernandez government, the regime that was basically installed actually with U.S. support and complicity. And this is, of course, all following the coup in 2008 against Manuel Zelaya, which was supported by the United States government. In particular, people escaping Honduras have been escaping the repression of the Juan Orlando Hernandez regime, which was installed with the support of U.S. support. Hillary Clinton very much acknowledged her own complicity in supporting the overthrow of Manuel Zelaya back in 2008. And so since then, we've had several governments in Honduras that have been involved in political repression. And so basically, this has resulted in a scenario where many asylum seekers are escaping organizations, whether that's gang organizations, narco organizations, political groups that are often following these people all the way to Mexico. And so they're potentially vulnerable to, you know, being found, right, by the people, the very people that they're trying to escape. And in addition to that, we know there's been several studies that have been done that show that asylum seekers that have been placed in the Remain in Mexico program are basically precariously housed or homeless, you know. So in Matamoros, it's very well known. In Tijuana and other places, there's tent encampment cities where asylum seekers are forced to live in, where many have been victims of violence from just everyday sort of violence of people stealing things from them, or, you know, trying to take advantage of them, kidnappings, even things like that. So really, the Remain in Mexico program has been disastrous, right? On a very personal and intimate level, it's been disastrous for people in terms of the violence that they've experienced during the time that they've had to wait. Await their asylum court date. So yeah, the Trump administration has severely attacked the asylum process overall, and, you know, has also in general just continued earlier policies of deportation of migrants inside the United States. So it's been a pretty bad 4 years in general.
That's the voice of Carlos Martinez. He is talking to us about what is happening at the border, but he's a PhD candidate in the joint program of medical anthropology at UC Berkeley and at UCSF, and he has been focusing his research on this. So, Carlos, you are now in Tijuana. You've actually been doing your research in Tijuana, not just talking about Tijuana far away, but what are you seeing? Talk to us about the material realities. What are the conditions under which people are experiencing either being stuck, victims of this policy change where they are victims of, you know, MPP, or they are, maybe they are recently deported. Like you said, deportation is, you know, has been an ongoing huge human rights issue that people are experiencing, but it's something that has been acutely felt right now in Tijuana. So tell us about the types of conditions people are in Tijuana that you're seeing.
Yeah, so you know, Tijuana has really been, in many ways, since its inception, a city of migrants, right? When whether that was Mexicans themselves coming from interior kind of parts of Mexico into Tijuana, eventually going into the United States, or being simply a kind of launching point for people trying to enter the United States from, you know, all parts of Latin America, right? But that's become, you know, much more the case under the Trump administration. You know, as I said, under the Remain in Mexico program, it's very much become the case for thousands of Central Americans. But this is also, it's also become the home to many deportees, right? And this is also a legacy, in particular, of the Obama administration, who, you know, many referred to as the deporter in chief, right? And it's very true that Obama, under the Obama administration, there was a record number of deportations, you know, Mexicans and Central Americans. And, you know, Tijuana in particular is been the city that has received the highest number of deportees from the United States for several years. So, for example, in 2019, I believe, Tijuana received about 27,000 deportees. So this was the greatest number of people who have been deported for the United States of all ports of entry. And, you know, several, many of these people, you know, they return back to other parts of Mexico to where they're from in many cases. But there are also many who end up kind of stranded in Tijuana. Maybe they were from Tijuana or from other parts of Baja California, but if not, they might not even have sort of familial connections anymore in any case. And they often have to access some form of shelter, and those tend to be limited, really hundreds of shelters throughout Tijuana for both asylum seekers from Central America as well as deportees. But in many cases, you know, the amount of time they can stay in those that don't charge them can be limited. And then there are many kind of formal kind of shelters, really homeless shelters, where they have to pay small amounts of money to stay in. And this really results in a situation where many actually end up in a condition of homelessness. And so the homeless population in Tijuana, which has really grown significantly, you know, as we've seen in actually many cities in the United States, but I think what's really different in some ways about the homeless community in Tijuana is that it's not homegrown homelessness as much as people who were deported. So, for example, and this is now kind of an older study that was done from 2013, but that study that was done by people from the Colegio de la Frontera found that something like 90% of the people that they surveyed, of the homeless people they surveyed in Tijuana, living in the Tijuana River Canal, had been deported. This is something that I've definitely found in my own research. Basically, in many ways, the homeless community is a community of deportees, and many of them end up living in the Tijuana River Canal. They're generally very much subject to all kinds of police violence and also forced drug rehabilitation. And that's really been, in many ways, the focus of some of my research, where, you know, looking at the way that the kind of local government in Tijuana, as well as with the support from federal government of Mexico, has sought to sort of manage this homeless population of deportees, along with managing sort of this influx of asylum seekers at the same time, and sort of dealing with these two kind of stateless, in what I refer to as sort of a stateless subjects, right? So in the sense that even though they might be Mexican deportees, they often lack any form of identification, which gives them sort of access to healthcare services and things like that. If they do have identification, it's actually often stolen from them. It's a very common practice for police to actually strip homeless deportees of all their belongings, including their identifications. And so in some ways, stripping them of their citizenship, essentially, because they often are asked for that when they need to access any sort of services. In many ways, both Central American migrants and kind of Mexican deportees find themselves in some of the, in this similar sort of condition. In some ways, Mexican deportees end up, those who are homeless end up in some of the most, in some of the worst conditions, in that they're consistently being jailed by police, often several times a week, kind of cycled in and out of the local jail, forced into drug rehab centers, even if they don't have drug problems in some cases. And so, I mean, the conditions are often pretty awful to witness, to be honest. And it's become only kind of more challenging, I would say, during this last year with the COVID pandemic.
So, Carlos Martinez, you've been in Tijuana doing your research, and you've been thinking and writing a lot about how how public health and social justice and human rights intersect. So can you tell us, specifically thinking about COVID, what are some of the main challenges people are facing? I can only imagine what it's like to be unhoused in Tijuana. As you said, that many of the shelters are full, many people are unsheltered. What are some of the other issues of water and food and other basics in terms of keeping people safe from COVID? What are you seeing and seeing in terms of transmission and how people are able to cope with this pandemic?
Yeah, so in general, like in many places, of obviously, you know, the COVID pandemic has overwhelmed the medical system, right, in Tijuana, as you would imagine, right? And it's also in some ways sort of overwhelmed the infrastructure of support that is present in Tijuana and other border cities to support migrants and deportees. And so, as I mentioned, there's something like, you know, hundreds of shelters throughout Tijuana that provide temporary shelter, in some cases for free, in some cases for, you know, small charge, although that's not an insignificant thing to have to pay for many of these people. And, you know, when the COVID pandemic actually started, many of these shelters basically shut their doors, right, in order to protect the people that were currently living there. And so preventing asylum seekers and anybody who needed shelter, in some cases, from being able to access shelter if they weren't already in there. And so that really complicated the housing situation for many people. In response, there have been a few kind of local responses to that, with, some, in some cases, international support. So the International Organization of Migration has helped to create a kind of temporary hotel for asylum seekers during the COVID pandemic, knowing that many shelters, as I mentioned, were not letting new people in. And there was also a temporary kind of shelter set up for deportees who were homeless, who had some sort of addiction, although that was a pretty short-lived experiment, to be honest. And even during the kind of early days of the pandemic, actually, there was a sharp reduction in the kind of police detention of homeless people, as we saw in, I think, other cities as well, in the United States as well. But really, after a few months of kind of hiatus of sort of a moment for, in some ways, these communities to be able to breathe and without being locked up by police on a daily basis, the police reinitiated their attacks on homeless people. And so in addition to that, the health sector has definitely been overwhelmed. The Tijuana General Hospital, along with other public hospitals or public clinics, converted into basically treating patients only with COVID. And so that complicated care for people tremendously who needed any sort of medical care outside of sort of COVID, for any current medical condition aside from COVID, right? So in many cases, people are basically being told to go to other cities like Rosarito and Tecate in order to access care. And of course, that's impossible for many people, right, to get to travel to a whole other city, especially in emergency situations. And so, to be honest, we don't really know the amount of collateral damage that has resulted from this overwhelm of the medical system, right? I've seen it, you know, I've experienced it in that I've had to personally transfer patients myself through the kind of volunteer work that I've been doing to Rosarito, for example. In one case, a patient that was on the verge of dying, who certainly would have died if we hadn't taken him to the hospital, for example, and, you know, was not able to access care anywhere in Tijuana. I would never have been able to access care and go take himself to Rosarito, right? And then just recently, I witnessed another kind of these situations where the Red Cross, which is sort of a charitable medical organization, right, isn't part of sort of the public health infrastructure, has also been overwhelmed and is often not picking up patients, right, and not giving them treatment. And so I've seen, you know, patients who have been basically discarded, essentially, particularly homeless patients, and who have died as a result, right? And so we don't, I think, have a real good numerical kind of account of the level of impact that's had, right? But I can say absolutely for sure that it's resulted in a lot of unfortunate and unnecessary death and suffering for people.
I'm Carlos Martinez, and we're talking about how changes in asylum policy, so the process for which people request asylum, as well as an increase in deportation and how COVID, all these things have led to a really tremendous difficult situation in Tijuana and other border cities where people are, as you said, unnecessarily dying. Like, you know, we don't know the number, as you just said, but do know that there has been tremendous excess death. Many, many people have died that, you know, should not have died because of these different policies and practices that have made it so much harder for people to live. So I really want to hear about the many organizations, some of which you just mentioned you're volunteering with some organizations. Could you tell us about some of the organizations on the ground that are helping people and really not just providing for basic needs like what you just described, you know, maybe helping water or even food, but even as much as getting people to the hospital or getting them the medical and health care they need. So tell us a little bit about those groups.
Yeah, so, you know, there's several organizations on the ground in Tijuana, as there are in other border cities as well, that have been providing really critical kind of support for asylum seekers as well as deportees for years, really. And I've been really fortunate to work closely with a couple of groups in Tijuana that have been doing really important work in that regard. So one organization that has been active for several years called the Wound Clinic. Was started by Dr. Patricia Gonzalez-Zuniga, and she's been doing really incredible work in basically harm reduction work and providing basic, urgent kind of emergency medical care to Tijuana's homeless deportee communities, basically doing street medicine for several years with the support of doctors often coming from the United States. And she's been organizing kind of these street clinics for now at least 4 years, I believe, where often there's a distribution of needles for people who need those, who are injection drug users, since that's often something that they can't access generally, right? And in doing that in order to, of course, prevent people from, you know, spreading, limiting the spread of HIV and other kind of diseases that are result from sharing of needles, but also really providing wound care for people who are injection drug users or any kind of really basic care that people just don't have access to. And again, these are folks who that she's treating are mainly people who have been deported, who are thus Mexican themselves, and who ostensibly have access to the public healthcare system, but are often discriminated against when they arrive at the public hospital and are just generally unable to access medical care very often. And so her organization, the Wound Clinic, has been really important. And you know, she's developed an incredible amount of trust with those communities. And, you know, the saying of her organization is support, don't punish, you know, as sort of a response to a punitive approach, the kind of heavy-handed ways that the government has dealt with these communities, supposedly out of a desire to kind of come down on drug use, right? And so so that's been a great organization to work with. And then also another group that's been active, particularly that formed following the 2018, the arrival of the 2018 migrant caravans. And I got involved with them actually since that time, and then kind of got re-involved with them when I arrived in Tijuana. And that organization is the Refugee Health Alliance. And they are another really incredible organization that is often, you know, generally a lot of doctors and other kind of medical professionals from the United States have been volunteering their time at a clinic in Tijuana. And they really serve both communities. They provide care to often the homeless deportee community, as well as asylum seekers. And they've been doing all kinds of things, going to shelters, doing clinics in shelters, and providing just medical care on a daily basis to people. Also, really, they have a strong emphasis on providing care for the LGBTQ migrant community, even providing kind of hormone therapy support. So they're just another organization that's been doing really great work over the last several years.
That's the voice of Carlos Martinez. He is doing research right now in Tijuana. He is a PhD candidate at the Joint Program of Medical Anthropology at UC Berkeley and UCSF. Carlos, thank you so much about talking to us about what's happening on the ground. We really, really appreciate your insight and a little bit of a picture, a window into the reality that so many people are facing and that we don't get to really see. So, Carlos, you just talked to us about Wound Clinic and also Refugee Health Alliance. How do people connect with these organizations?
Yeah, so the Wound Clinic, you can find them at www.woundclinictj.org and also on Facebook. And then the Refugee Health Alliance, you can find them at refugeehealthalliance.org as well. They also have a Facebook page and Instagram and other stuff. Yeah, both organizations are always really in need of all kinds of support, whether that's financial or donations and or just volunteers, people who do have any sort of medical experience in particular, but any kind of buddy, anybody who's willing to come to Tijuana to volunteer. You know, there's all kinds of real support that's needed on the ground. You know, as I mentioned, it's continues to be a really kind of disastrous situation for migrants in many cases who are currently stuck in these border cities. And it is a major kind of humanitarian issue that I believe is the responsibility of people in the United States, given migration policy, right? And the history of migration policy and also in recent years, the you know, Trump's attacks on asylum. And so, you know, I do think that it's important that we provide as much support as we can to these communities, especially during this time, you know, to the degree that's possible, of course, given the pandemic and everything like that. I understand that, you know, personal volunteering is not always possible, but any kind of support is always needed.
Muchísimas gracias, Carlos. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for giving us an insight into what's going on the ground in Tijuana at this time.
Thank you so much, Julita, for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Hi, this is Greg Landau here on Crónicas de la Raza, and tonight we're going to be listening to music by the Mexican singer-composer Laura Rebolloso. Laura is well known in the Son Jarocho community as one of the innovators in Son Jarocho playing the leona, a bass instrument. And Laura was a founding member of the group Son de Madera and also has performed on her own, has her own ensemble. Laura Rebolloso's work has been compared to that of Frida Kahlo as she depicts many of the struggles that women face in daily life, the pains of childbirth, bringing up children, and just working and being productive members of society. She's an accomplished composer. This is her third album that has come out, and she's been a part of several very innovative ensembles as she combines elements of traditional Son Jarocho with jazz, modern contemporary music elements, and many others. She's traveled all over the world with her music, giving workshops, seminars, and participating in festivals in the United States and all over Europe. So we're going to hear her words in English, speaking about her work. This is her latest record called Canciones y Sones para Reverdecer, Songs of Renewal.
Tangueo Enamorado is dedicated to cowards to love. It is so difficult for two souls to meet and fall in love. I mean deep love, but some runs away. They don't want to keep that unique love. The great treasure of love dies. Someone cries at the bottom of the sea. El cielo está anunciando los nuevos tiempos donde el corazón resuena que perdona.
Thank you.
Mujer Rota, Broken Woman. It is dedicated to my friend Yvonne, that she lived with a man who beat her. In a red down, she appeared lifeless. She died from beatings in his own house. He has studied a lot and had a good job, but her husband apparently was very polite. She couldn't get out of that relationship, despite all her academic training. She died from beatings in her own house. That day, Monica Maria Fimbres, who is a musician from California, visited me in my house at Jalapa, Veracruz, because we wanted to work on a song. I suddenly knew that news, and my own story was removed, and I became one with so many women who suffered violence. So we record this song that the same day when Yvonne died. We record at the night, Monica Maria and my daughter, Lucia, who is 19 years old, and she is a singer, and me playing the jarana and singing. After that, Jerónimo González produced the music with more instruments. For me, being a musician is a fight. Es una lucha por continuar mi vocación en la música y en la composición. Sin vida, no encontrabas la salida de esto. aviso, warning, is about see your personal story, see how your garden or heart has dried. A seal opens, the veil falls for a moment. Someone in heaven has a well of water to wash away all your pain. What has your heart, which is river and has dried?
Es río el que se ha sentado. que se ha acercado.
¿Cuánto das tú? How much do you give? It's about an existential question. People ask you, what you work on? A mirror asks you, what you work on? Love also asks you the same question. How much heart do you give? How much silence? How many words do you give? How much consideration? How much peace do you give?
Por un enfermo, tierra, que yo trabajo por la humanidad, que yo trabajo por el cielo, que yo trabajo por el cielo. ¿Cuánto das tú? ¿Cuánto das?
This is Greg Landau, and you've been listening to an interview with Laura Rebolloso from her record Canciones y Sones para Reverdecer here on La Raza Chronicles. This is available on all the digital platforms. Laura Rebolloso with Canciones y Sones para Reverdecer.
You've been listening to La Raza Chronicles, Crónicas de la Raza. If you'd like to stay up on our news, like us on Facebook at La Raza Chronicles on Facebook. If you want to hear this program or share it with a friend, you can go to soundcloud.com/La Raza Chronicles and share it. If you have any ideas for interviews we should be doing or would like to get involved with our collective, you can email us at La Raza Chronicles@kpfa.org. Muchísimas gracias y buenas noches.